This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders and the Birth of the FBI by David Graham. Read for you by Will Patton, Anne-Marie Lee, and Danny Campbell.
Chronicle 1. The Marked Woman. There had been no evil to mar that propitious night, because she had listened. There had been no voice of evil. No screech owl had quaveringly disturbed the stillness. She knew this because she had listened all night. John Joseph Matthews, Sundown. 1. The Vanishing. In April, millions of tiny flowers spread over the blackjack hills and vast prairies in the Osage Territory of Oklahoma. There are Johnny Jump-Ups and Spring Beauties and Little Bluets. The Osage writer John Joseph Matthews observed that the galaxy of petals makes it look as if the gods had left confetti. In May, when coyotes howl beneath an unnervingly large moon, taller plants, such as spiderworts and black-eyed Susans, begin to creep over the tinier blooms, stealing their light and water. The necks of the smaller flowers break, and their petals flutter away, and before long they are buried underground. This is why the Osage Indians refer to May as the time of the flower-killing moon. On May 24th, 1921, Molly Burkhart, a resident of the Osage settlement town of Gray Horse, Oklahoma, began to fear that something had happened to one of her three sisters, Anna Brown. 34 and less than a year older than Molly, Anna had disappeared 3 days earlier. She had often gone on sprees, as her family disparagingly called them, dancing and drinking with friends until dawn. But this time, one night had passed, and then another, and Anna had not shown up on Molly's front stoop as she usually did, with her long black hair slightly frayed and her dark eyes shining like glass. When Anna came inside, she liked to slip off her shoes, and Molly missed the comforting sound of her moving, unhurried, through the house. Instead, there was a silence as still as the plains. Molly had already lost her sister Minnie nearly 3 years earlier. Her death had come with shocking speed, and though doctors had attributed it to a peculiar wasting illness, Molly harbored doubts. Minnie had been only 27 and had always been in perfect health. Like their parents, Molly and her sisters had their names inscribed on the Osage roll, which meant that they were among the registered members of the tribe. It also meant that they possessed a fortune. In the early 1870s, the Osage had been driven from their lands in Kansas onto a rocky, presumably worthless reservation in northeastern Oklahoma, only to discover decades later that this land was sitting above some of the largest oil deposits in the United States. To obtain that oil, prospectors had to pay the Osage for leases and royalties. In the early 20th century, each person on the tribal roll began receiving a quarterly check. The amount was initially for only a few dollars, but over time, as more oil was tapped, the dividends grew into the hundreds, then the thousands, and virtually every year the payments increased, like the prairie creeks that joined to form the wide, muddy Cimarron, until the tribe members had collectively accumulated millions and millions of dollars. In 1923 alone, the tribe took in more than $30 million, the equivalent today of more than $400 million. The Osage were considered the wealthiest people per capita in the world. Lo and behold, the New York Weekly Outlook exclaimed, the Indian, instead of starving to death, enjoys a steady income that turns bankers green with envy. The public had become transfixed by the tribe's prosperity, which belied the images of American Indians that could be traced back to the brutal first contact with whites, the original sin from which the country was born. Reporters tantalized their readers with stories about the plutocratic Osage and the red millionaires with their brick and terracotta mansions and chandeliers, with their diamond rings and fur coats and chauffeured cars. One writer marveled at Osage girls who attended the best boarding schools and wore sumptuous French clothing as if une très jolie demoiselle of the Paris boulevards had inadvertently strayed into this little reservation town. At the same time, reporters seized upon any signs of the traditional Osage way of life, which seemed to stir in the public's mind visions of wild Indians. One article noted a circle of expensive automobiles surrounding an open campfire where the bronzed and brightly blanketed owners are cooking meat in the primitive style. Another documented a party of Osage arriving at a ceremony for their dances in a private airplane, a scene that outrivals the ability of the fictionist to portray. Summing up the public's attitude toward the Osage, the Washington Star said, "That lament, Lo, the poor Indian, might appropriately be revised to, Ho, the rich redskin." Gray Horse was one of the reservation's older settlements. These outposts, including Fairfax, a larger neighboring town of nearly 1,500 people, and Pawhuska, the Osage capital, with a population of more than 6,000, seemed like fevered visions. The streets clamored with cowboys, fortune seekers, bootleggers, soothsayers, medicine men, outlaws, U.S. marshals, New York financiers, and oil magnates. Automobiles sped along paved horse trails, the smell of fuel overwhelming the scent of the prairies. Juries of crows peered down from telephone wires. There were restaurants advertised as cafes and opera houses and polo grounds. Although Molly didn't spend as lavishly as some of her neighbors did, she had built a beautiful rambling wooden house in Gray Horse near her family's old lodge of lashed poles, woven mats, and bark. She owned several cars and had a staff of servants, the Indians' potlickers, as many settlers derided these migrant workers. The servants were often black or Mexican, and in the early 1920s, a visitor to the reservation expressed contempt at the sight of even whites performing all the menial tasks about the house to which no Osage would stoop. Molly was one of the last people to see Anna before she vanished. That day, May 21st, Molly had risen close to dawn, a habit ingrained from when her father used to pray every morning to the sun. She was accustomed to the chorus of meadowlarks and sandpipers and prairie chickens, now overlaid with the pock-pocking of drills pounding the earth. Unlike many of her friends, who shunned Osage clothing, Molly wrapped an Indian blanket around her shoulders. She also didn't style her hair in a flapper bob, but instead let her long black hair flow over her back, revealing her striking face with its high cheekbones and big brown eyes. Her husband, Ernest Burkhart, rose with her. A 28-year-old white man, he had the stock handsomeness of an extra in a Western picture show. Short brown hair, slate blue eyes, square chin. Only his nose disturbed the portrait. It looked as if it had taken a barroom punch or two. Growing up in Texas, the son of a poor cotton farmer, he'd been enchanted by tales of the Osage Hills, that vestige of the American frontier where cowboys and Indians were said to still roam. In 1912, at 19, he'd packed a bag, like Huck Finn lighting out for the territory, and gone to live with his uncle, a domineering cattleman named William K. Hale in Fairfax. "He was not the kind of man to ask you to do something. He told you," Ernest once said of Hale, who became his surrogate father. Though Ernest mostly ran errands for Hale, he sometimes worked as a livery driver, which is how he met Molly, chauffeuring her around town. Ernest had a tendency to drink moonshine and play Indian stud poker with men of ill repute, but beneath his roughness there seemed to be a tenderness and a trace of insecurity, and Molly fell in love with him. Born a speaker of Osage, Molly had learned some English in school. Nevertheless, Ernest studied her native language until he could talk with her in it. She suffered from diabetes, and he cared for her when her joints ached and her stomach burned with hunger. After he heard that another man had affections for her, he muttered that he couldn't live without her. It wasn't easy for them to marry. Ernest's roughneck friends ridiculed him for being a squaw man. And though Molly's three sisters had wed white men, she felt a responsibility to have an arranged Osage marriage the way her parents had. Still, Molly, whose family practiced a mixture of Osage and Catholic beliefs, couldn't understand why God would let her find love only to then take it away from her. So, in 1917, she and Ernest exchanged rings, vowing to love each other till eternity. By 1921, they had a daughter, Elizabeth, who was 2 years old, and a son, James, who was 8 months old and nicknamed Cowboy. Molly also tended to her aging mother, Lizzie, who had moved into the house after Molly's father passed away. Because of Molly's diabetes, Lizzie once feared that she would die young and beseeched her other children to take care of her. In truth, Molly was the one who looked after all of them. May 21st was supposed to be a delightful day for Molly. She liked to entertain guests and was hosting a small luncheon. After getting dressed, she fed the children. Cowboy often had terrible earaches, and she'd blow in his ears until he stopped crying. Molly kept her home in meticulous order, and she issued instructions to her servants as the house stirred, everyone bustling about, except Lizzie, who'd fallen ill and stayed in bed. Molly asked Ernest to ring Anna and see if she'd come over to help tend to Lizzie for a change. Anna, as the oldest child in the family, held a special status in their mother's eyes, and even though Molly took care of Lizzie, Anna, in spite of her tempestuousness, was the one her mother spoiled. When Ernest told Anna that her mama needed her, she promised to take a taxi straight there, and she arrived shortly afterward, dressed in bright red shoes, a skirt, and a matching Indian blanket. In her hand was an alligator purse. Before entering, she'd hastily combed her wind-blown hair and powdered her face. Molly noticed, however, that her gait was unsteady, her words slurred. Anna was drunk. Molly couldn't hide her displeasure. Some of the guests had already arrived. Among them were two of Ernest's brothers, Brian and Horace Burkhart, who, lured by black gold, had moved to Osage County, often assisting Hale on his ranch. One of Ernest's aunts, who spewed racist notions about Indians, was also visiting, and the last thing Molly needed was for Anna to stir up the old goat. Anna slipped off her shoes and began to make a scene. She took a flask from her bag and opened it, releasing the pungent smell of bootleg whiskey. Insisting that she needed to drain the flask before the authorities caught her, it was a year into nationwide prohibition, she offered the guests a swig of what she called the best white mule. Molly knew that Anna had been very troubled of late. She'd recently divorced her husband, a settler named Oda Brown, who owned a livery business. Since then, she'd spent more and more time in the reservation's tumultuous boom towns, which had sprung up to house and entertain oil workers, towns like Whizbang, where it was said people whizzed all day and banged all night. All the forces of dissipation and evil are here found, a U.S. government official reported. Gambling, drinking, adultery, lying, thieving, murdering. Anna had become entranced by the places at the dark ends of the streets. The establishments that seemed proper on the exterior, but contained hidden rooms filled with glittering bottles of moonshine. One of Anna's servants later told the authorities that Anna was someone who drank a lot of whiskey and had very loose morals with white men. At Molly's house, Anna began to flirt with Ernest's younger brother, Brian, whom she'd sometimes dated. He was more brooding than Ernest and had inscrutable yellow-flecked eyes and thinning hair that he wore slicked back. A lawman who knew him described him as a little roustabout. When Brian asked one of the servants at the luncheon if she'd go to a dance with him that night, Anna said that if he fooled around with another woman, she'd kill him. Meanwhile, Ernest's aunt was muttering, loud enough for all to hear, about how mortified she was that her nephew had married a redskin. It was easy for Molly to subtly strike back, because one of the servants attending to the aunt was white, a blunt reminder of the town's social order. Anna continued raising Cain. She fought with the guests, fought with her mother, fought with Molly. She was drinking and quarreling, a servant later told authorities. I couldn't understand her language, but they were quarreling. The servant added, they had an awful time with Anna, and I was afraid. That evening, Molly planned to look after her mother while Ernest took the guests into Fairfax, 5 miles to the northwest, to meet Hale and see Bringing Up Father, a touring musical about a poor Irish immigrant who wins a $1 million sweepstakes and struggles to assimilate into high society. Brian, who'd put on a cowboy hat, his cat-like eyes peering out from under the brim, offered to drop Anna off at her house. Before they left, Molly washed Anna's clothes, gave her some food to eat, and made sure that she'd sobered up enough that Molly could glimpse her sister as her usual self, bright and charming. They lingered together, sharing a moment of calm and reconciliation. Then Anna said goodbye, a gold filling flashing through her smile. With each passing night, Molly grew more anxious. Brian insisted that he'd taken Anna straight home and dropped her off before heading to the show. After the third night, Molly, in her quiet but forceful way, pressed everyone into action. she dispatched Ernest to check on Anna's house. Ernest jiggled the knob to her front door. It was locked. From the window, the rooms inside appeared dark and deserted. Ernest stood there alone in the heat. A few days earlier, a cool rain shower had dusted the earth, but afterward the sun's rays beat down mercilessly through the blackjack trees. This time of year, heat blurred the prairies and made the tall grass creak underfoot. In the distance, through the shimmering light, one could see the skeletal frames of derricks. Anna's head servant, who lived next door, came out, and Ernest asked her, "Do you know where Anna is?" Before the shower, the servant said, she'd stopped by Anna's house to close any open windows. "I thought the rain would blow in," she explained, but the door was locked, and there was no sign of Anna. She was gone. News of her absence coursed through the boom towns, traveling from porch to porch, from store to store. Fueling the unease were reports that another Osage, Charles Whitehorn, had vanished a week before Anna had. Genial and witty, the 30-year-old Whitehorn was married to a woman who was part white, part Cheyenne. A local newspaper noted that he was popular among both the whites and the members of his own tribe. On May 14th, he'd left his home in the southwestern part of the reservation for Pawhuska. He never returned. Still, there was reason for Molly not to panic. It was conceivable that Anna had slipped out after Brian had dropped her off and headed to Oklahoma City or across the border to incandescent Kansas City. Perhaps she was dancing in one of those jazz clubs she liked to visit, oblivious of the chaos she'd left trailing in her wake. And even if Anna had run into trouble, she knew how to protect herself. She often carried a small pistol in her alligator purse. "She'll be back home soon," Ernest reassured Molly. A week after Anna disappeared, an oil worker was on a hill a mile north of downtown Pawhuska when he noticed something poking out of the brush near the base of a derrick. The worker came closer. It was a rotting corpse. Between the eyes were two bullet holes. The victim had been shot execution style. It was hot and wet and loud on the hillside. Drills shook the earth as they bore through the limestone sediment. Derricks swung their large clawing arms back and forth. Other people gathered around the body, which was so badly decomposed that it was impossible to identify. One of the pockets held a letter. Someone pulled it out, straightening the paper, and read it. The letter was addressed to Charles Whitehorn, and that's how they first knew it was him. Around the same time, a man was squirrel hunting by Three Mile Creek, near Fairfax, with his teenage son and friend. While the two men were getting a drink of water from a creek, the boy spotted a squirrel and pulled the trigger. There was a burst of heat and light, and the boy watched as the squirrel was hit and began to tumble lifelessly over the edge of a ravine. He chased after it, making his way down a steep wooded slope and into a gulch where the air was thicker and where he could hear the murmuring of the creek. He found the squirrel and picked it up. Then he screamed, "Oh, Papa!" By the time his father reached him, the boy had crawled onto a rock. He gestured toward the mossy edge of the creek and said, "A dead person." There was the bloated and decomposing body of what appeared to be an American Indian woman. She was on her back, with her hair twisted in the mud and her vacant eyes facing the sky. Worms were eating at the corpse. The men and the boy hurried out of the ravine and raced on their horse-drawn wagon through the prairie, dust swirling around them. When they reached Fairfax's main street, they couldn't find any lawmen, so they stopped at the Big Hill Trading Company, a large general store that had an undertaking business as well. They told the proprietor, Scott Mathis, what had happened, and he alerted his undertaker, who went with several men to the creek. There they rolled the body onto a wagon seat and, with a rope, dragged it to the top of the ravine, then laid it inside a wooden box in the shade of a blackjack tree. When the undertaker covered the bloated corpse with salt and ice, it began to shrink as if the last bit of life were leaking out. The undertaker tried to determine if the woman was Anna Brown, whom he'd known. The body was decomposed and swollen almost to the point of bursting and very malodorous. He later recalled, adding, "It was as black as a nigger." He and the other men couldn't make an identification. But Mathis, who managed Anna's financial affairs, contacted Molly, and she led a grim procession toward the creek that included Ernest, Brian, Molly's sister Rita, and Rita's husband Bill Smith. Many who knew Anna followed them, along with the morbidly curious. Kelsey Morrison, one of the county's most notorious bootleggers and dope peddlers, came with his Osage wife. Molly and Rita arrived and stepped close to the body. The stench was overwhelming. Vultures circled obscenely in the sky. It was hard for Molly and Rita to discern if the face was Anna's. There was virtually nothing left of it, but they recognized her Indian blanket and the clothes that Molly had washed for her. Then Rita's husband, Bill, took a stick and pried open her mouth, and they could see Anna's gold fillings. "That is sure enough Anna," Bill said. Rita began to weep, and her husband led her away. Eventually, Molly mouthed the word, "Yes, it was Anna." Molly was the one in the family who always maintained her composure, and she now retreated from the creek with Ernest, leaving behind the first hint of the darkness that threatened to destroy not only her family, but her tribe. 2. An Act of God or Man. A coroner's inquest, composed of jurors and led by a justice of the peace, was hastily convened at the ravine. Inquests were a remnant of a time when ordinary citizens largely assumed the burden of investigating crimes and maintaining order. For years after the American Revolution, the public opposed the creation of police departments, fearing that they would become forces of repression. Instead, citizens responded to a hue and cry by chasing after suspects. Benjamin N. Cardozo, the future Supreme Court Justice, once noted that these pursuits were made not faintly and with lagging steps, but honestly and bravely, and with whatever implements and facilities are convenient and at hand. Only in the mid-19th century, after the growth of industrial cities and a rash of urban riots, after dread of the so-called dangerous classes surpassed dread of the state, did police departments emerge in the United States. By the time of Anna's death, the informal system of citizen policing had been displaced, but vestiges of it remained, especially in places that still seemed to exist on the periphery of geography and history. The Justice of the Peace selected the jurors from among the white men at the ravine, including Mathis. They were charged with determining whether Anna had died by an act of God or man, and if it had been a felony, then they were tasked with trying to identify the principals and the accessories to the crime. Two doctors, the brothers James and David Schoen, who cared for Molly's family, had been summoned to perform an autopsy. Leaning over the body with members of the inquest huddled around them, they began to diagnose the dead. Each corpse tells its own story. A fractured hyoid, a bone in the neck that supports the tongue, can indicate that a person has been strangled. Marks on the neck can further reveal whether the killer used his bare hands or a cord. Even a victim's torn fingernail can speak of a fateful struggle. An influential 19th-century manual on medical jurisprudence cited the saying, "A medical man, when he sees a dead body, should notice everything." The Schoen brothers set up a plank as a makeshift table. From a medical bag, they removed a few primitive instruments, including a saw. The heat slithered into the shade. Flies swarmed. The doctors examined the clothes Anna wore, her bloomers, her skirt, searching for unusual tears or stains. Finding nothing, they tried to determine the time of death. This is more difficult than generally presumed, particularly after a person has been dead for several days. In the 19th century, scientists believed that they had solved the riddle by studying the phases a body passes through after death. The stiffening of the limbs, rigor mortis, the corpse's changing temperature, algor mortis, and the discoloring of the skin from stagnant blood, liver mortis. But pathologists soon realized that too many variables, from the humidity in the air to the type of clothing on the corpse, affect the rate of decomposition to allow a precise calculation. Still, a rough estimate of the time of death can be made, and the Schoens determined that Anna had been deceased between 5 and 7 days. The doctors shifted Anna's head slightly in the wooden box. Part of her scalp slipped off, revealing a perfectly round hole in the back of her skull. "She's been shot," one of the Schoens exclaimed. There was a stirring among the men. Looking closer, they saw that the hole's circumference was barely that of a pencil. Mathis thought that a .32-caliber bullet had caused the wound. As the men traced the path of the bullet, it had entered just below the crown on a downward trajectory, there was no longer any doubt. Anna's death had been cold-blooded murder. Lawmen were then still largely amateurs. They rarely attended training academies or steeped themselves in the emerging scientific methods of detection, such as the analysis of fingerprints and blood patterns. Frontier lawmen, in particular, were primarily gunfighters and trackers. They were expected to deter crimes and to apprehend a known gunman alive, if possible, dead, if necessary. An officer was then literally the law, and nothing but his judgment and his trigger finger stood between him and extermination. The Tulsa Daily World said in 1928, after the death of a veteran lawman who'd worked in the Osage Territory. It was often a case of a lone man against a pack of cunning devils. Because these enforcers received pitiful salaries and were prized for being quick draws, it's not surprising that the boundary between good lawmen and bad lawmen was porous. The leader of the Dalton Gang, an infamous 19th-century band of outlaws, once served as the main lawman on the Osage Reservation. At the time of Anna's murder, the Osage County Sheriff, who carried the bulk of responsibility for maintaining law and order in the area, was a 58-year-old 300-pound frontiersman named Harve M. Frias. A 1916 book about the history of Oklahoma described Frias as a terror to evildoers. But there were also murmurings that he was cozy with criminal elements, that he gave free rein to gamblers and to bootleggers like Kelsey Morrison and Henry Grammer, a rodeo champion who had once served time for murder and who controlled the local distribution of moonshine. One of Grammer's workers later admitted to authorities, "I had the assurance that if I was ever arrested, I would be turned out in 5 minutes." A group of citizens from Osage County had previously issued a resolution on behalf of religion, law enforcement, home decency, and morality, stating that the people who believe a sworn officer of the law should enforce the law are hereby urged to see or write Sheriff Frias at once and urge upon him to do his sworn duty. When Sheriff Frias was informed about Anna's murder, he was already preoccupied with Whitehorn's slaying, and he initially sent one of his deputies to collect evidence. Fairfax had a town marshal, the equivalent of a police chief, who joined the deputy at the ravine while the Schoen brothers were still conducting the autopsy. To identify the murder weapon, the lawmen needed to extract the bullet that was apparently lodged in Anna's skull. Using their saw, the Schoens cut through her cranium, then carefully lifted her brain and placed it on the plank. "The brains were in such bad shape," David Schoen recalled, "you couldn't trace the bullet at all." He picked up a stick and probed the brain. The bullet, he announced, was nowhere to be found. The lawmen went down to the creek, scouring the murder scene. By a rock on the bank were smears of blood, marking where Anna's body had lain. There was no sign of the bullet, but one of the lawmen noticed a bottle on the ground, which was partially filled with a clear liquid. It smelled like moonshine. The lawmen surmised that Anna had been sitting on the rock, drinking, when someone came up behind her and shot her at close range, causing her to topple over. The marshal spotted two distinct sets of car tracks running between the road and the gulch. He called out, and the deputy sheriff and the inquest members rushed over. It looked as though both cars had come into the gulch from the southeast, then circled back. No other evidence was collected. The lawmen were untrained in forensic methods and didn't make a cast impression of the tire marks or dust the bottle for fingerprints or check Anna's body for gunpowder residue. They didn't even photograph the crime scene, which, in any case, had already been contaminated by the many observers. Someone, though, retrieved one of Anna's earrings from her body and brought it to Molly's mother, who was too ill to venture to the creek. Lizzie instantly recognized it. Anna was dead. As with all Osage, the birth of her children had been the greatest blessing of Wakonda, the mysterious life force that pervades the sun and the moon and the earth and the stars, the force around which the Osage had structured their lives for centuries, hoping to bring some order out of the chaos and confusion on earth, the force that was there but not there, invisible, remote, giving, awesome, unanswering. Many Osage had given up their traditional beliefs, but Lizzie had held on to them. A U.S. government official had once complained that women like Lizzie keep up the old superstitions and laugh down modern ideas and customs. Now someone, something, had taken Lizzie's oldest and most favored daughter before her allotted time, a sign perhaps that Wakonda had withdrawn his blessings and that the world was slipping into even greater chaos. Lizzie's health grew even worse, as if grief were its own disease. Molly relied on Ernest for support. A lawyer who knew them both noted that his devotion to his Indian wife and his children is unusual and striking. He comforted Molly as she threw herself into organizing Anna's funeral. There were flowers to be purchased, along with a white metal coffin and a marble tombstone. Undertakers charged the Osage exorbitant rates for a funeral, trying to gouge them, and this was no exception. The undertaker demanded $1,450 for the casket, $100 for preparing and embalming the body, and $25 for the rental of a hearse. By the time he was done tallying the accessories, including gloves for the gravedigger, the total cost was astronomical. As a lawyer in town said, "It was getting so that you could not bury an Osage Indian at a cost of under $6,000, a sum that, adjusted for inflation, is the equivalent of nearly $80,000 today." The funeral was arranged to reflect the family's Osage and Catholic traditions. Molly, who had gone to a missionary school in Pawhuska, regularly attended Mass. She liked to sit in the pews as the Sunday morning light came through the windows and listen to the sermon of the priest. She also liked to socialize among friends, and there was plenty of that on Sundays. The funeral service for Anna began at the church. William Hale, Ernest's uncle, was very close to Anna and Molly's family, and he served as one of the pallbearers. The priest chanted the rhythmic 13th-century hymn, Dies Irae, which culminates with a supplication, "Sweet Jesus, Lord most blessed, grant the dead eternal rest." After the priest sprinkled holy water over Anna's casket, Molly guided her family and the other mourners to a cemetery in Greyhorse, a quiet, isolated spot overlooking the endless prairie. Molly's father and her sister Minnie were buried there in adjoining plots, and beside them was a freshly dug pit, damp and dark, awaiting Anna's casket, which had been transported to the edge of the gravesite. Her tombstone bore the inscription, "Meet me in heaven." Ordinarily at the cemetery, the lid of a coffin was lifted a final time before interment, allowing loved ones to say goodbye, but the condition of Anna's body made that impossible. More troubling, her face couldn't be painted to signal her tribe and clan, a tradition at Osage funerals. If this ritual of ornamentation didn't occur, Molly feared Anna's spirit might be lost. Still, Molly and her family placed enough food in the casket for Anna's 3-day journey to what the Osage refer to as the Happy Hunting Ground. The older mourners, like Molly's mother, began to recite Osage prayer songs, hoping that Wakonda would hear them. The great historian and writer John Joseph Matthews, 1894-1979, who was part Osage, documented many of the tribe's traditions. Describing a typical prayer, he wrote, "It filled my little boy's soul with fear and bittersweetness, an exotic yearning, and when it had ended and I lay there in my exultant fear trance, I hoped fervently that there would be more of it, and yet I was afraid that there might be. It seemed to me later, after I had begun to reason, that this prayer song, this chant, this soul-stirring petition, always ended before it was finished in a sob of frustration." At the gravesite, standing with Ernest, Molly could hear the old people's song of death, their chants interspersed with weeping. Oda Brown, Anna's ex-husband, was so distraught that he stepped away. Precisely at noon, as the sun, the greatest manifestation of the great mystery, reached its zenith, men took hold of the casket and began to lower it into the hole. Molly watched the glistening white coffins sink into the ground until the long, haunting wails were replaced by the sound of earth clapping against the lid. 3. King of the Osage Hills. The killings of Anna Brown and Charles Whitehorn caused a sensation. A banner headline in the Pawhuska Daily Capital read, "Two separate murder cases are unearthed almost at same time." Theories proliferated about who might be responsible. Two bullets were retrieved from Whitehorn's skull, and they appeared to have come from a .32 caliber pistol, the same kind of weapon that had been suspected in Anna's murder. Was it just a coincidence that both victims had been wealthy Osage Indians in their 30s? Or was this perhaps the work of a repeat killer, someone like Dr. H.H. Holmes, who had murdered at least 27 people, many of them during the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago? Lizzie relied on Molly to deal with the authorities. During Lizzie's lifetime, the Osage had become dramatically unmoored from their traditions. Louis F. Burns, an Osage historian, wrote that, after oil was discovered, the tribe had been set adrift in a strange world, adding, "There was nothing familiar to clutch and stay afloat in the world of white man's wealth." In the old days, an Osage clan, which included a group known as the Travelers in the Mist, would take the lead whenever the tribe was undergoing sudden changes or venturing into unfamiliar realms. Molly, though she often felt bewildered by the upheaval around her, took the lead for her family, a modern traveler in the mist. She spoke English and was married to a white man, and she had not succumbed to the temptations that had hurt many young members of the tribe, including Anna. To some Osage, especially elders like Lizzie, oil was a cursed blessing. "Someday this oil will go, and there will be no more fat checks every few months from the Great White Father," a chief of the Osage said in 1928. "There'll be no fine motor cars and new clothes. Then I know my people will be happier." Molly pressed the authorities to investigate Anna's murder, but most officials seemed to have little concern for what they deemed a dead Injun. So Molly turned to Ernest's uncle, William Hale. His business interests now dominated the county, and he had become a powerful local advocate for law and order, for the protection of what he called God-fearing souls. Hale, who had an owlish face, stiff black hair, and small alert eyes set in shaded hollows, had settled on the reservation nearly two decades earlier. Like a real-life version of Faulkner's Thomas Sutpen, he seemed to have come out of nowhere. A man with no known past. Arriving in the territory with little more than the clothes on his back and a worn Old Testament, he embarked on what a person who knew him well called a fight for life and fortune in a raw state of civilization. Hale found work as a cowboy on a ranch. Before trains crisscrossed the West, cowboys drove cattle from Texas to Osage Territory, where the herds grazed on the lush, blue-stem grass, and then on to Kansas for shipment to slaughterhouses in Chicago and other cities. These drives fueled the American fascination with cowboys, but the work was hardly romantic. Hale toiled day and night for a pittance. He rode through storms, hail, lightning, sand, and survived stampedes, guiding the cattle into smaller and smaller circles before they could trample him. His clothes carried the stench of sweat and manure, and his bones were frequently battered, if not broken. Eventually, he hoarded and borrowed enough money to buy his own herd in Osage Territory. He is the most energetic man I ever knew, a man who invested in his business recalled. Even when he crossed the street, he walked as if he were going after something big. Hale soon went bankrupt, an embittering failure that only stoked the furnace of his ambition. After he started over in the cattle business again, he often slept in a tent on the cold, windy plains, alone in his fury. Years later, a reporter described how he'd still pace before a fire like a leashed animal. He nervously rubbed his hands into the flames. His rather ruddy face was aglow with cold and excitement. He worked with the fever of someone who feared not only hunger, but an Old Testament God who, at any moment, might punish him like Job. He became an expert at branding, dehorning, castrating, and selling stock. As his profits rose, he bought up more territory from the Osage and neighboring settlers until he had amassed some 45,000 acres of the finest grazing land in the county, as well as a small fortune. And then, in that uncanny American way, he went to work on himself. He replaced his ragged trousers and cowboy hat with a dandified suit and a bow tie and a felt hat, his eyes peering out through distinguished round-rimmed glasses. He married a schoolteacher and had a daughter who adored him. He recited poetry. Pawnee Bill, the legendary Wild West showman and the one-time partner of Buffalo Bill, described Hale as a high-class gentleman. He was named a reserve deputy sheriff in Fairfax, a position that he would continue to hold. The title was largely honorific, but it enabled him to carry a badge and to lead posses, and he sometimes kept one pistol in his side pocket and another strapped to his hip. They represented, he liked to say, his authority as an officer of the law. As his wealth and power grew, politicians courted his support, knowing that they couldn't win without his blessing. He outworked and outwitted his rivals, making plenty of enemies who wanted him dead. Some did hate him, a friend admitted. Still, Molly Burkhart and many others considered him Osage County's greatest benefactor. He aided the Osage before they were flush with oil money, donating to charities and schools and a hospital. Assuming the mantle of a preacher, he signed his letters, Reverend W. K. Hale. A local doctor said, "I couldn't begin to remember how many sick people have received medical attention at his expense, nor how many hungry mouths have tasted of his bounty." Later, Hale wrote a letter to an assistant chief of the tribe saying, "I never had better friends in my life than the Osages. I will always be the Osages' true friend." In this last remnant of the American frontier, Hale was revered as the King of the Osage Hills. Hale frequently came by Molly's house to collect Ernest, and not long after Anna's burial, Hale showed up to pay his respects to Molly and her mother. He vowed to obtain justice for Anna. With his supreme confidence and his mastery of that secret world of whites, he often wore a diamond-studded pin from the Masonic Lodge, it didn't seem to matter that he had no formal role in the murder investigation. He had always expressed affection for Anna. "We were mighty good friends," he said. And during another visit, Molly could see him huddled with Ernest, apparently talking about hunting down whoever had murdered her sister. Members of the coroner's inquest, along with the county prosecutor, continued investigating Anna's death, and shortly after Anna's burial, Molly went to give evidence at a hearing in Fairfax. The Department of the Interior's Office of Indian Affairs, which oversaw government relations with tribes and was later renamed the Bureau of Indian Affairs, had a field agent assigned to the Osage Territory who knew Molly. He said that she was willing to do everything she can in order to bring the guilty parties to justice. The authorities had provided a translator for Molly, but she waved him off and spoke in succinct English, the way the nuns had taught her as a child. Molly described for the jurors the final time that Anna visited her house. She said that Anna had left around sundown. In a later proceeding, a government official asked her, "How did she go?" "She goes in a car." "Who was with her?" "Brian Burkhart." "Did you notice which direction they went?"
"Towards Fairfax."
"Was anyone else in the car with Brian and Anna?"
"No, just Brian and Anna."
"Did you see her any more alive after that?"
Molly stayed composed. "No," she said.
"You saw her body after it was found?"
"Yes."
"How long was it about after this time you saw her leave your mother's place with Brian Burkhart, you saw her body?"
"About 5 or 6 days."
"Where did you see the body?"
"At the pasture. Just right there."
At the inquest, while Molly seemed eager to answer every question to make sure that nothing was missed, the justice of the peace and the jurors asked her barely anything. Perhaps they discounted her because of prejudice, because she was an Osage and a woman. The panel questioned with greater depth Brian Burkhart, about whom many locals had begun to whisper. After all, he was the last person seen with Anna before she went missing. Brian lacked the good looks of his brother Ernest, Molly's husband, and there was something cold about his appearance. He had uncomfortably steady eyes. Hale had once caught him stealing his cattle, and to teach his nephew a lesson, filed charges against him. The county prosecutor asked Brian about the day that he said he'd given Anna a ride to her house.
"When you brought her back, where did you go?"
"Come to town."
"When was this?"
"About 5 or 4:30.
"You haven't seen her since then?"
"No, sir." At one point, the county prosecutor paused and asked,
"Positive?"
"Yes, sir." At a later hearing, Ernest was also questioned. A law enforcement official pressed him about his brother.
"You understand he is the last person seen with this woman, Anna Brown?"
"I understand," Ernest replied, adding that Brian told him
he left her at her house. That is his story.
"Do you believe it?"
"Yes, sir."
Brian was detained by the authorities after the first hearing. To Molly's distress, they even held Ernest, too, in case he was covering for his younger brother. But both men were soon turned loose. There was no evidence implicating Brian other than the fact that he'd been with Anna before she disappeared. When Ernest was asked if he had any information as to how Anna met her death, he said no, adding,
"I don't know of enemies she had or anyone that disliked her."
A prevailing theory was that her killer came from outside the reservation. Once the tribe's enemies had battled them on the plains. Now they came in the form of training.